Way back in the 1990s, I had a small law practice down in Florida with just one partner, my wife. Hi, honey. And we specialized in, we like to say that we specialized in anything that walked in the door, especially early in our practice when clients were scarce. But you know, generalists in the law are more and more infrequent, and most lawyers these days will specialize in this or that. But we've got a real treat for you today. We've got one of the few remaining generalists in the law. His name is Ed Kelly, and he is the general counsel of East Tennessee State University. And boy, does he have lots and lots of constitutional stories to tell us. It's your weekly constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris, and our subject today is the University Council. Stick around.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
We produce the radio show, Your Weekly Constitutional, at WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee, but sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle that WETS is associated with a university, and the name of the university is East Tennessee State University, ETSU, for those in the know. And I actually have lots of dealings with ETSU, with a number of people in the departments of political science, sometimes, believe it or not, even in the public health school, and perhaps most frequently with the general counsel. His name is Ed Kelly, and Ed and I actually met a number of years ago at the Appalachian School of Law. We both started working there at roughly the same time because he'll actually drive up every now and then and teach a course in this or that important subject. And Ed is an absolutely delightful fellow with a delightful career story and delightful stories to tell us all about what he does now. Because you see, he's the general counsel for the entire university, and there are just thousands and thousands of students here who do thousands and thousands of different things on a daily basis. And many, many times, constitutional issues will come across his desk. It was actually my wife, Priscilla, who said to me one day, you know, you really need to have Ed on the show because he's got lots and lots that your listeners will be interested in. Well, guess what, honey? You were right.
Well, Ed Kelly, welcome to your weekly constitutional.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm the University Counsel at East Tennessee State University and the Quillen College of Medicine. I also have the privilege of teaching with you at Appalachian School of Law on occasion. And I've been here at ETSU since 1997 as University Counsel. And prior to that, I was assistant to the president with the State University of New York at Brockport. And before that, I represented State University of New York as an assistant attorney general for the state of New York. So I've been pretty much in higher education since 1979 and am liking it and seeing it's very different every single day. Every Monday I come in and I see things I've never seen before, thanks to the ingenuity of our various student bodies. I've always maintained that we could, if we could channel the energy and the creativeness of our students from Friday afternoon until Monday morning and put that into the actual academic week, we would have Nobel Prize winners, we'd be curing all sorts of diseases, and life would be much better. But the actual creativity of this, it seems, of the college student is really exhibited over the weekends.
I see. You know, that's very interesting because it reminds me of something someone told me years ago. They said most unplanned teenage pregnancies occurred between the hour of 3 p.m. and 6 p.m. in the late afternoon. And I thought about that for a moment, and then I thought, oh, of course, that's when they're at home unsupervised. Mm-hmm. And in much the same fashion, you've identified a similar problem period during the weekends of university life. That's when the problems arise, right?
Right, and for university counsel, I see those problems on Monday morning.
Well, I must say I'm very glad in at least two different respects. Well, three different respects. First of all, it is a pleasure to have you here with us, Ed, because you and I go back a number of years, and I been a great pleasure to have you up at the Appalachian School of Law, and you've taught some very important courses up there to great acclaim. It's also very nice to talk about East Tennessee State University some. We don't do that as often as I'd like to, but of course WETS here is you know, sponsored by and associated with ETSU. So happy to do that. And then finally, the very idea of a university council is, as you say, a very eclectic one and a very interesting one. So why don't we start our discussion, with that today? What does a university council do? And then maybe we'll talk about some of the more interesting things you've done.
Well, I tell my law students that they can't really name an area of law that we don't practice here in the university. We have primarily what we find is a lot of constitutional issues, issues of due process, academic freedom, freedom of speech for faculty and for others. And those things take a great deal of our work. But we have contract issues. We were working on them this morning, actually. Mm-hmm. We have tort issues because we're almost like a small city. We have people slipping and falling. We have a number of enterprises and activities, including this radio station, mm-hmm. that have legal issues of one kind or another.
Wayne is always getting in trouble, isn't he?
Wayne gets into trouble more than his share.
Yeah, but, you know, that goes all the way back to his childhood.
We work with him.
He'd get kicked out of school, and I can imagine he would just keep you on your toes.
Right.
All right. And then what else?
Well, university advancement. We work with the states and wills and people who are donors who are a major asset to this university and to the Quillen College of Medicine. Mm-hmm. We work very closely with a public safety. We have our own police department on campus, so we do some criminal work as well. We have a Division I athletics program, so we're working with the NCAA and other entities. We have a College of Medicine, which leads to a number of medical issues involving medical malpractice, issues involving physicians and physician compensation, issues involving residents and medical students that take quite a bit. We have a doctoral program in nursing. We have one of the few colleges of public health in the country, mm-hmm. which deals with international programs, and we have a tremendous number of international programs here at ETSU in countries all over the world. So I'm constantly looking at students who are going to Somalia and Rwanda, as well as Canada and France, mm-hmm. and all of the issues that go with that as well. So it's a broad practice. And it's a very exciting practice. There's always something very interesting on the plate.
You are a jack of all trades.
Pretty much everyone.
And you have a 50-lawyer staff to assist you with these issues,
No,
right?
We have two lawyers. We have an associate counsel and an assistant counsel who are the brains of the outfit.
I see. And you're just the pretty face.
I
understand.
Face.
All right. Well, of that great universe of cases, you mentioned that constitutional issues are prominent among them. What are some of your interesting constitutional cases? Let's talk about them.
Well, some of them involve, in a recent issue we've had, is the use of our public forum, mm-hmm. Which would be the area outside of our library and near Rogers Stout, which is probably the most trafficked place on campus, which is why we said this is a public forum. And you could go back to really in Britain, if you go to Hyde Park or you go to some of the places there, you'll see people there speaking out, people speaking on religious topics or civics topics, people who aren't related to the university but have something to say. And when we decide a place is a public forum, we regulate the time, place, and circumstance, but we don't regulate the content of people who come. So we get some very interesting speakers who show up on campus.
I bet
and,
you do.
And we have a number of issues with them. Mm-hmm. And that's one constitutional issue that we have.
Before we
and
go,
we've seen a lot of litigation about those constitutional issues, not only in Tennessee but in public universities all over the country.
Sure. Let me put a little bit of context here. I've not been to Hyde Park, but I understand that if you go there, you will literally see people climbing atop soapboxes, which is where mm-hmm. the expression comes from. And that example is an example itself on how tradition and history come into constitutional law. Because one way that the Supreme Court looks at the speech and press clauses of the First Amendment is to say, let's think about places where speech can be regulated or not. And it divides them typically into three categories. It will, the one you mentioned, traditional public fora, places where speech has traditionally taken place and people have traditionally gathered to debate and discuss matters of importance. And very little regulation is allowed there. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, only time, place, and manner. And the classic example is you can't, you know, have an amplified sound truck at 2 a.m. in a residential neighborhood.
Right.
But beyond those sorts of sort of common sense, reasonable regulation, the state really cannot regulate those four at all. And it certainly cannot regulate, except in the most extreme circumstances, any content that's being espoused by any speaker. There are a couple of other categories that aren't really that relevant here. I'll simply say that there are some other places, for example, the inside of government office buildings, where you can't go in and just make a speech because
that's
it's going to interfere with business. But you're talking about the traditional public forum. And
mm-hmm.
so that's where everybody goes, including the kookiest of speakers. So I imagine you've had some issues with that.
And continue to do so. Pretty much every year we'll have protests from faculty members who feel disturbed by the language of the people who are speaking,
mm-hmm.
Students protesting the language of people who are speaking or the exhibits that people bring and put on campus. And
give us some examples.
Well, we've had a group who are a very pro-life group that will put up pictures of aborted fetuses.
Ouch.
And those kinds of things, which are very disturbing to students.
Right.
We haven't had that on this campus.
Is that protected speech? Is that something that they're allowed to display?
It's symbolic speech, and mm-hmm. it is protected. And
so if I want to take a really explicit photograph of an aborted fetus, which is going to be very unpleasant for anybody to look at, and mm-hmm. I want to blow it up and put it on a great big poster and say, look, I'm pro-life, and this is what you're doing. You're killing these babies. That's protected.
Right. If they comply with our time, place, circumstance, and they use a public forum
mm-hmm.
for doing so, that would be protected. And we've had instances where there's been litigation over those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
We have various speakers from various religious denominations who maintain some pretty, not violent, pretty scary comments to and about students who might be walking by regarding their dress, regarding their behavior.
So they'll
those
see
those kinds
a,
of things to engage discussion.
Right.
And one of the things that we have an issue with is what we call a heckler's veto,
mm-hmm.
where a person will come on and will be talking to this, and the students themselves will react very loudly to the point where the person can't speak anymore. And the issue there is to maintain and protect the person's right to speak at the same time recognizing the student's right to disagree with the person without putting that person in a position where he can't speak.
I have heard of some rather aggressive evangelists singling out people, for example, a young woman who they think is immodestly dressed, and they will then say, you're a whore, or
mm-hmm.
you're this or that, you're a harlot. And of course, the student in question is not very happy about this. Is that the sort of circumstance you're talking about?
Right. And students who are gay, lesbian, may also feel that they're very attacked and consider that a very unfriendly, very hostile environment when these things occur. And that does happen, yes. And we've had that circumstance happen here. But those students seem to be of the thought that the answer to bad speech is good speech, is more speech.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see some very active and very, and sometimes very, very good arguments going on.
Right.
In these areas, which I guess is one of the reasons we have such an open free speech area at the university.
Is that how it's typically resolved, those particular circumstances, is that there's simply a debate, and even though feelings might get hurt, the speaker is allowed to speak? Or have you ever had a circumstance where you've actually had to shut someone down?
No, not since I've been here. I've never seen a situation where we've had to shut someone down. What we have had to do, because the public forum is relatively close to a academic building, is tone down the volume.
Okay, and that would just be a manner restriction.
Faculty, right, where it interferes with faculty or others. Or we might, I don't know if we do this, but we might restrict the time during exam week, for instance.
Oh, that's okay.
That
that's another good example. It's a time
because,
restriction.
Yeah, because the students really have to get into the library, which is right, one would have to walk right through that public forum to get to the library. So on the one hand, it's a wonderful place to be speaking because you have access to all the students. On the other, it's a place where students do have to get in and around, so we have to be careful to maintain an appropriate level balance between student access to buildings they have to get to and the ability of the person to speak.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Our subject today is the University Council. Now, that's not just a generic title. It's the actual title of a fellow by the name of Ed Kelly, and he's telling us all about his many constitutional adventures. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back for some more war stories from Ed Kelly. So stick around.
And lawyers, guns, and money. Guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money.
It's time again for the constitutional quiz, and with me is the quiz guy, Doug Smith.
Hey, Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing very well. What do you got for us this week?
Hey, Stuart, how's your wife?
Well, my wife is fine. How's your wife?
Sweetest woman on the planet. Your wife right after mine. Honey, I love you.
Yeah, we both love our wives. We're great guys.
Yeah. Well, I'm asking that because this week it's all about a wife. A wife. Here's the question. What is the minimal age set by the U.S. Constitution for marriage?
The minimal age set by the U.S. Constitution for marriage. That is a tough one. What are the choices?
So it's not how old, but how young can you be to be married based on the U.S. Constitution? So here's answer number one, 21, until the 26th Amendment that changed it to 18, similar to voting.
I see. Okay, that's answer choice A.
B, 14 years old.
Really?
Yeah, well, think about it. The Wild West, heading west,
okay,
younger and younger.
Okay. Well, I guess so, yeah.
C, 19, unless a citizen's birth state constitution supersedes with a younger age.
Oh, so a citizen could have a state constitution that lets the person marry at a younger age is what that answer choice suggests.
If the state constitution supersedes the U.S. Supreme.
Okay.
In fact. And then D, it does not specify an age.
Okay, so four choices. What's the minimal age set by the U.S. Constitution? We got 21, 14, 19, and no specified minimum. Do we have a contestant?
Yes, we do. Shauna from South Carolina.
Shauna from South Carolina. And what do you think about this?
Well, first of all, Shauna, are you married?
Yes, I am, to Christopher, and he's here to help me.
Uh-huh.
I thought I did not want to get it wrong.
I see. Okay. Well, it's appropriate. A married person should have some help on this one. Okay. Well, do you have any proposed answer to this quiz?
Well, I was thinking 14, but you have to have parental consent with that one. So I'm going to guess 19. And what do you think, Chris? He's saying it doesn't specify.
Oh, so your husband doesn't think there is an age.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to say 19.
Well, hold on. We got conflicting answers here. We got a married couple with conflicting answers. Which one are we supposed to go with? Was your final answer?
Okay, which one are we going to go with our final answer? We're going to say, okay, I'm going to go with him, which I'm sure he's wrong, but
You're sure your husband's wrong, but you're going to back away and let him give the answer.
And what's your husband's name again?
His name is Chris. Say hi, Chris.
Hello.
So, Chris, you're going to be the one, you're going to be the man of the house on this one and answer the question?
Absolutely.
I hope you're right, buddy.
Okay, so we're going to go with it doesn't specify, even though I think 19, but he's saying it doesn't specify.
Well, I'm not just saying this because I'm a dude and I'm in solidarity with Chris, but it actually does not specify.
Oh, he's right? Oh, wow.
Oh, boy. Yeah, Chris, I don't know whether to congratulate you or say that you're in trouble, my friend.
This is one of the many instances where states actually legislate this kind of practice. They get to decide how old you are. In fact, it used to be that states decided how old you would be even to vote. But now that has been, you know, that's been really consolidated at the federal level. Everybody recognizes 18 now. But state to state, you could have different ages, and you could have different tests or procedures that you have to go by in order to get a marriage license. But Chris, you're right. The U.S. Constitution doesn't delve into that, doesn't legislate, and it does not specify.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations. You got it right. Now, here's the next question. Okay. You only get one shirt, so who gets the shirt?
Well, I guess I'll give him my shirt.
You're going to give him your shirt? How come?
I'll get the shirt and give it to him.
She's going to give him the shirt off of her back.
Yeah. He won, well, but I'll take the shirt and give it to him.
That's love for you. Well, tremendous. And congratulations to both of you for winning it. In fact, I don't know. Maybe we'll give him two shirts. What do you think, Doug?
You know, they are from South Carolina.
So. Okay, we'll give them two shirts.
Good folks from South,
South Carolina. Thanks very much for playing the constitutional quiz.
Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks, Doug.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Ed Kelly, who's the University Counsel at East Tennessee State University, where WETS is located and where we produce the show. Ed's a fascinating fellow, and he's been talking about all the constitutional issues that come before him and before other university councils at other large state universities. We were talking specifically about free speech, which is a big issue for most college campuses, and about the concept of time, place, and manner restrictions. It turns out that as long as the colleges and universities don't regulate content, they can actually regulate time, place, and manner of expression.
And that's okay, as long as you're not, as long as you're doing that sort of time, place, or manner restriction without reference to the speaker, as without reference to what the speaker is espousing.
Right.
And that's fine, but you mentioned something else here that's one of the most difficult challenges in this area, and that is the conflict between two competing constitutional values, free speech, which we've been focusing upon, and another one, equality, which is, of course, what a student who's gay might feel is being attacked. If the gay student's walking on campus and then a speaker starts attacking that student for being gay, one can imagine a circumstance where that student might then turn around and sue the university for allowing a hostile environment where the student feels like he or she is being discriminated against. How would that be resolved, or has that situation arisen?
Well, it hasn't. It has not arisen. We do have clubs of the lesbian, gay, and groups, transgendered students do have organizations. They're very active on campus. They are a part and parcel of the university community. They they're very involved in student government. They're very involved in the academic life of the campus. We have gay faculty and staff. So I think today the ability to react, or the ability to non-react to what's perceived as very inappropriate language is still there. The person feels secure. They can react in a positive way to those allegations. And I think what people are seeing here when that activity takes place is the support of students, not only gay students, but heterosexual students, supporting the gay students in protesting the particular speaker.
Okay, so once again, the remedy for bad speech is more speech.
It's good speech.
Not less speech, exactly right. As long as people don't get violent. You know, as by and large, the speech is going to prevail.
Right. And the public university has been, you know, part and parcel of American life. I think Thomas Jefferson, if we look at his gravestone, he doesn't talk about being president, and he doesn't talk about the Louisiana Purchase. And on his gravestone, he says, the founder, the author of the Declaration of Independence, got the Statute for Religious Freedom in the state in Commonwealth of Virginia, and the founder of the University of Virginia as a public university. So the public university, right from the beginning, has been part of American life and the American tradition. So we want to be very careful to make sure that as a public university, we maintain the constitutional values.
Well, good for you, Ed. I'm very good for you. It's always troubling to me when I hear people, perhaps for the best of motives, calling for the suppression of speech. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've made it clear whenever this has come up that, you know, somebody who's out there shouting obscenities or saying nasty things to students does not speak for the university, and yet the university has to respect that person's right to speak. Indeed, it goes beyond the First Amendment. It goes to the whole issue of inquiry. It goes mm-hmm. to the whole issue of free exchange of ideas, which, of course, universities are supposed to champion. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what it always strikes me about these people who want to suppress campus speech, is if any place is supposed to champion the free exchange of ideas, even offensive ones, even minority ideas, it's supposed to be a university. So I'm glad you've been doing that.
Right. One of the problems that I think we as universities have is we'll look at the legal ways that we can regulate speech, and sometimes be a little too rigid with our rules. For instance, there's a case now that, and I forget the name of the school, that had a student who was passing out the Constitution. And was actually charged and is going through a disciplinary hearing for passing
copies
of the
Constitution. Someone brought that to my attention, and I've been meaning to look into it for a show mm-hmm. idea. I don't really know too much about it. Apparently, there was some sort of time, place, or manner restriction.
Time, place, or manner. And the university, in its defense, said, we don't let anybody pass out anything. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we're disciplining you for passing out the Constitution.
So it's a content neutral regulation. So in mm-hmm. one sense, it's possibly permissible, and yet in this case,
it isn't.
kid brought out a Constitution. I mean, that's pretty hard to defend.
Right. Yeah. Well, in our case, for many years, I don't know if they still do, but the Gideons would be here passing out Bibles
right.
at the beginning of the school year, and they do that on a regular basis. Well, having the Gideons pass out. The Bible is, at least from my Christian tradition, might be a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. But once we allow that, we have to allow other people to pass out tracts as well. Other people, other religious tracts, we mm-hmm. have to allow them to pass out tracts that might be racist, tracts that might
yeah.
be that might be very offensive.
You could have the Nazis here distributing Mein Kampf.
We could,
yeah.
and hopefully we won't, but we could. And mm-hmm. once we decide this is what we're going to allow, we're going to have this open, then that's an issue. At one point, we had a philosophy professor here, a good friend of mine who's left, who became the head of the atheists, National Atheist Organization,
mm-hmm.
and he made a point of having the atheists have their convention here. In our student union, and
mm-hmm.
of course, being a very religious area and strong Bible Belt, we did get concerns about why we would allow the atheists. Well, we do allow religious organizations to, like anyone else, to use our facilities as long as they meet our rules. We weren't in a position to tell the atheists they couldn't come.
And I bet that did spark a bit of a controversy.
Very angry pastor call me up, and he said he couldn't believe that we would allow the atheists, and he was going to not allow them to come because, his higher power wouldn't allow it. And I said, well, my higher power, if he's very angry about something, he's got a track record of taking care of it, floods and locusts and turning people into pillars of salt.
Mm-hmm.
And he can take care of himself if he thinks that this shouldn't happen. But maybe your higher power just doesn't need your help.
Uh-huh.
And the pastor laughed and said, I see your point, but I'm going to protest anyway.
Well, and he has a right to protest.
Yeah, and he did.
And that's fine. And moreover, I'm sure you pointed this out, no one's making that pastor have the atheist come to his church.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to do that, but at a public university, which is owned by the government, by mm-hmm. all of us, the rules are different. And that,
right.
The government cannot discriminate based upon people's viewpoints. What other constitutional issues? I mean, we talked a lot about free speech here. What other constitutional issues do you find particularly interesting here?
Well, there's the issue of free speech in the public forum, but then there's the issue of what goes on in the classroom. Is academic freedom.
That's a big one.
And the ability of a person to teach in the class. I was reading of a young woman named Adler at University of Colorado Boulder yesterday, who is a tenured professor who had one of the more popular classes in her entire university, where she had a particular class where she talked about prostitution. Mm-hmm. And she would have teaching assistants dress up as different kinds of prostitutes, the so-called crack whore, the escort, the heroin addict, the and those kinds of the illegal immigrant, these kinds of people who are brought into the sex worker business. And the teaching assistants, who are volunteers, would talk about prostitution from that point of view. They would do research and they would do this. And it, a very popular class, one of the more popular classes in the entire university, had been going on for quite some time, but the university directed her to stop doing that. And in fact, threatened to terminate her employment. And she resigned rather than be terminated, announced that she was resigning, and there's a major protest going on now at the University of Colorado Boulder regarding her academic freedom to teach the way that she wants to teach.
And that is remarkable. I mean, there are really two issues here. The First Amendment issue, of course, is mm-hmm. At the root of all of this. I mean, it's the state, right? It's the
right.
University of Colorado. That is suppressing her speech because, of course, she's speaking through these students and through their role playing. And then beyond that, there's the academic value of academic freedom, which probably, I'm going to guess, the University of Colorado is contractually bound to respect when it grants tenure to these people. Mm-hmm. So I bet they're going to be on the receiving end of a lot of lawsuits about that case.
Well, and it's a long and very, very... interesting history mm-hmm. of academic freedom. The Red Book of the American Association of University Professors, going back to 1940, is a statement regarding academic freedom. During the so-called Red Scares of the 1950s, we hear about people in Hollywood who were blacklisted or fired because of their belief, but there were many professors in the academic world who lost their positions because they didn't take loyalty oaths, so they lost their positions regarding what they were teaching or where they had been or what their political views were. And as a result, the American Association of University Professors established guidelines on academic freedom. What goes on inside the classroom is very important. The
right.
Supreme Court has recognized in any number of cases, mostly in dicta, that academic freedom is a very important part of higher education. And what the ability of a teacher to teach inside the classroom, if it's a matter related to that class, is something that the courts really shouldn't interfere with. Now, that doesn't give free rein. I can't go into, say, my class in disability law and talk about my opinions on Obamacare.
Right.
I can't go and I can't be abusive in class to
right.
students. But I should have the ability to present my material in the way that I see fit in order to effectively teach. It's something to be in the classroom and for someone to say, well, you can teach, but be careful not to get anyone uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Well, the fact is, teaching is making people feel uncomfortable.
Yep.
And I think the poet Yeats said, teaching isn't filling a bucket, it's lighting a fire. And when you light the fire, it's possible people are going to be uncomfortable at the time you're lighting the fire or as they feel the heat of it.
Right.
And good teaching may very well require us to make people feel uncomfortable. One of the disturbing things that we see in law today is the tendency of the Supreme Court, although they're catching on, the Supreme Court and other federal courts using high school cases, the Bongs for Jesus case or
right.
some other case, to and applying a high school case to a university.
Very different
cases.
Environment.
And the fact is, the environment is very different. It's
yes,
very
it is.
Different. And
it's the difference between children and adults.
Right. And one has to be very skeptical when someone is citing a high school case and trying to apply it to a university situation.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with University Counsel Ed Kelly of East Tennessee State University, and he's telling us all about the fascinating constitutional issues that come up in his job every day, as they do in the jobs of most general counsels at most big state universities. After the break, we'll talk some more with Ed Kelly. Don't touch that dial. And now let's finish our discussion with Ed Kelly, the University Counsel at East Tennessee State University.
Well, anything else, Ed? I'm sure you've got lots of other, what other types of constitutional issues?
Another major issue we're seeing with Virginia Tech and with some of the events in Newton and some other areas are the issues of guns on campus.
Oh, yeah.
The issues of people with mental illness who may be coming onto campus, because mental illness is a disability, and we certainly want to make sure we accommodate individuals with mental illness, but we also want to make sure that we maintain a very safe environment for everyone involved, and there's a balancing that goes on with that, too, to avoid stereotyping of people, to educate the community regarding regarding mental illness, regarding where it is, because people... Some people tend to take a look at some terrible thing that happened and then blame it on individuals with mental illness or individuals with the stigma or place a stigma on people with mental illness. And we have to be very, very careful, very wary to make sure that we protect those people with disabilities.
Well, you're required to, the Americans with Disability Act, right?
The Americans with Disabilities Act, the Vocational Rehabilitation Act,
right.
Before that made us... responsible for providing accommodations for individuals with disabilities. We have an obligation to make reasonable accommodations, but the parent is no longer involved in the decision making. The person is on their own when they come in with the help of the university, and that causes some problem with parents. We call them helicopter parents because they hover around their child.
I've met a
and
few
it's not
those,
only
yeah.
people with disabilities. That'll be those are some other people who may be a little too protected, who come onto the campus.
Right.
So we have to make sure that we work with people with disabilities, because the IDEA, when I was talking about it earlier, has been tremendously successful. People with disabilities are coming to college who never came to college before.
Right.
And that's a very good thing.
But the conflict arises when you get a kid, or a student, I should say, who comes into school and starts doing things that make other people feel threatened. And so then you get expressions or inquiries or complaints from students or perhaps professors who say, I think this kid is unsafe. That's a reasonable concern, it seems.
Right.
If someone comes to you and says, hey, I'm concerned about this guy, I'm afraid he might shoot the place up. Boy, you're between a rock and a hard place, aren't you?
Well, one of the nice things that in my personal situation is I worked my way through college and law school as a police officer.
Right.
So, I know the questions to ask.
Excuse me, Ed, have you done everything?
Just about everything.
Have you done every job there is? How old are you? you don't have to answer that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get...
I can say that I remember when the Beatles first became popular. So.
No. Good heavens. I seem to recall some of that, too. Mm-hmm. Let's get to... You mentioned guns on campus, too. Of course, that's a related issue. And I'm certainly not suggesting people who want to bring guns on campus want to shoot the place up necessarily. But there are some who are just the opposite. They mm-hmm. want guns. And they will say, I want them in case something like that happens. I want to be able to defend myself and perhaps others. What is the status of guns on campus at ETSU?
Well, there's various legislative initiatives that come up every year regarding, usually, recently, the legislative initiatives have been to broaden the scope of being able to keep guns on campus, to keep guns in one's trunk. We come from a hunting area. As a matter of fact, Appalachian, the School of Law, I know is a big hunting area.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I had one of my students in my disability law class who kept his rifle in the in his pickup truck and couldn't wait for class to be over during hunting season because he was out of there like a shot to get him a deer. And
deer, bear, and we're now repopulating Buchanan County with elk. They're not being hunted yet, but I think that's the expectation.
Well, thank God that he graduated, because you'd be repopulating it with elk and losing them just as quickly because
he was out pretty much
every day.
I see. All right.
And we have hunters here. We have people who do bring their weapons. It's a little different than New York, where we're much more skeptical of why people have guns than we might be here, where people have legitimate hunting and other interests that relate to guns. So we accommodate by the law that's in place at the time. We watch very carefully what the various legislative initiatives are.
What is the current law in Tennessee? Are students allowed to bring guns?
They're allowed
campus?
To keep them in their trunk.
Okay.
and is the law at the present time.
But no packing heat in the classroom.
No packing heat in the classroom. No packing heat up and down the dorms or anything like that. So.
And so far, people seem to be comfortable with this, or has it?
So far, they seem to be comfortable. So far, they seem to be comfortable. We've not had any major problems with it. Knock on wood. At this point, we have another constitutional issue we have is not just a Second Amendment issue of the right to bear guns. Although we did have a protest where students wanted to wear holsters on campus to indicate their support of the Second Amendment, and and the question then was, do we allow holsters? People to wear
empty holsters
on campus. And one of the thoughts, being an ex-police officer, was if I see an empty holster, I'm more scared than if I see a holster with a gun in it, because where's the gun is the first
thought that
went on. But it being a protest with all sorts of people wearing holsters, and we know why they're wearing holsters, that would not be a constitutional. That would not. It was a constitutional issue, but it certainly wouldn't be something we'd prohibit.
No, it's a First Amendment.
We have to discuss that.
Yeah, the expression is, I can't bring my gun on campus, and I think that's wrong. Therefore, I'm wearing an empty holster to demonstrate my dissatisfaction with this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you can resolve the public safety issue, they've got a pretty clear First Amendment right of expression there.
Right.
And is that how you resolved it?
That is how we resolved it.
Okay.
And fortunately, I have a listserv of other university attorneys. And when I run across situations like that, I usually put it on the listserv and get feedback from others as to which way they would come down on a particular issue. And the surprising thing is often that that there's rarely consensus.
Oh, really?
On a particular issue that we can, people can make some pretty good arguments on either side of a topic. They're good lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
So we have those issues. I would say next to free speech, due process issues are
huge.
Tell me
about that. Okay.
Well, if I'm throwing a student out of class, out of the university, on a disciplinary matter, they're entitled to a hearing before a student judiciary panel. And if we're looking at expulsion, they have the right to request a hearing under the Tennessee Uniform Administrative Procedures Act, which calls for a hearing officer and calls for depositions, calls for discovery, calls for a lot of things that you would get in a trial.
Right.
And, you know, the key thing to procedural due process is that the student get notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. So we have our regulations, which we believe do and have been upheld.
Let me interject there. People will throw around the term due process all the time. And, of course, this comes from the Constitution, both the Fifth and the 14th Amendment, that typically say, you know, no one's going to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And so life, not so much an issue here. Liberty, perhaps, maybe a property interest in an education. So that's going to key in the due process requirement, because the 14th Amendment applies applies that to directly to the states. But what I really want to say is that there's no general agreement on exactly how much process is due in any individual case. You've identified the basics. The basics of, everybody agrees, the most basic aspects of due process are that you have to be notified that you're in trouble, that you have to have an opportunity to be heard. Sometimes that is an opportunity before an independent, impartial tribunal. But then beyond that, there you can keep going. You can talk about the right to discovery, the right to cross-examine witnesses.
To have a lawyer present.
To have a lawyer present, to a right of an appeal, this right, that right. And you get to the point where you have a full-blown trial in front of an Article III judge, in a federal court someplace. I mean, that's sort of if you want to think about what the ultimate due process is, think of a death penalty case in the courts. And every possible fairness is going to be given to such a person, or at least ideally is these days. On the opposite end, you have these relatively informal administrative hearings where, you know, maybe people are concerned about fairness, but they don't necessarily follow any set procedures.
Right.
So that's when you say notice and an opportunity to be heard. That's where we're starting. That's sort of the spectrum of what we're talking about.
Right. And fortunately, we have regulations that outline what those rights are.
Right.
A procedure, a disciplinary process of some kind. One of the problems that we get into is if we don't follow our own procedure. That certainly is a violation of due process. I mean, it's because the courts say...
Perish the thought.
The
you wouldn't
say,
follow
you
your
made
own
the
procedures.
Rules and you didn't follow your own rules. And
that's a problem.
I always envision a lawyer talking to a jury and saying, well, the university got to declare what the game is, and they got to declare what the touchdown is, and they got to declare what uniforms you wear, and they got to declare how many points you got for a field goal, and they got to declare... all of this, and once they did, they didn't follow those rules.
Ouch.
They created new rules, and I've always got this vision of some lawyer telling a jury and going through why the university didn't follow its own rules
right. Is
my worst nightmare. So the first thing I do when I run into a situation is say, did we follow our rules?
That's important. So all of you ETS professors and administrators out there, listen to your general counsel, follow the rules, and I'm betting that if they don't know what the rules are, they can ask you and you'll tell them, right?
And we will. Okay, hopefully before they apply...
Yeah, prospectively, not retrospectively.
Yeah, prospectively.
So what, do you have any interesting cases involving due process recently that you're...
We always do. Now we have students who are being dismissed for disciplinary reasons, but then we have students who are being dismissed for academic reasons. Mm-hmm. They flunk out.
Right.
They don't do well. And those require a little less due process because it's an academic judgment, the student. But a disciplinary matter, because of the stigma and everything that attaches, there's a little bit more due process. When we move up into the graduate schools and, let's say, the medical schools, by that point, people have invested in their education.
It's very expensive.
$100,000, $200,000 in...
There's your property interest.
...in debt. Mm-hmm. And so when they're dismissed, whether it be for academic reason or for a disciplinary reason, they don't go gently into that good night. Mm-hmm. They litigate as well you or I would if there was that kind of matter at stake. Plus, there's a reputation, a lifelong dream to be a doctor, a lifelong dream to be a nurse,
sure.
A lifelong dream to be a lawyer.
Right.
Assuming people get lifelong dreams to be lawyers.
Sure they do. I'm sure you did. I did too.
Yeah,
okay.
They did. So so for them, the due process is extremely important. And they litigate pretty much all the way through on those cases. The other issue that comes up is with student affairs. There's a student affairs. People who go into student affairs tend to be very conscious of the person and the development of the person and the education of the person and the wellness of the person and the treatment of the person. So there's a collegial aspect to life on campus where mm-hmm. if a person's having a problem, I work with them. If the person has done something wrong, there's a way to correct that behavior. Those kinds of things. If I think the person has a mental illness issue, if the person has some reason that will affect the discipline, I try to deal with that collegially. At the same time, we might be taking an adversarial process through a TWAP to a Tennessee Uniform Administrative Procedures Act hearing or another hearing and making decisions on it. And what I'm constantly running into is this potential for conflict between the adversarial role that we have to play in a world that tends to be adversarial and litigious, and a collegial aspect of development and fostering the whole person that in a friendly and civil manner as well. So that conflict between
the collegial
and the adversarial is something.
I've taught at a number of institutions of higher learning over the last 20 years, and I've yet to meet any professor or administrator who wants to kick anybody out
mm-hmm.
or who wants to discipline anybody. In fact, I think it's probably the least popular subject that can come up for any person in higher education. That's a bad day when you receive an allegation of someone engaging in academic fraud or a disciplinary problem.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to deal with it because you're right that we're here to help educate people. We want every student to succeed. And it's just a misery when you have to cross over a line and start saying, well, for the good of the institution and, you know, mm-hmm. in the interest of justice, we have to engage in these adversarial proceedings. It's misery.
Right. And the question I think we have to ask ourselves and do the faculty, I know the faculty in our schools, they said, did we do everything we could?
Yes.
To make this student successful? Did we do everything we could? Is there something else we could do? I rarely see a case where a person hasn't had notice, hasn't had probation, hasn't had mentoring, hasn't mm-hmm. had a lot of opportunities to succeed. And, maybe in the wrong field. and maybe...
That's a sad day for everybody. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to change the subject. In fact, I'm going to change the subject really fundamentally here, because as fascinated as I am by all of these university council issues you're bringing up, I'm equally, maybe even more fascinated by you yourself and your checkered past.
Well, in my youth, when I went to the University of Buffalo out of high school, I learned a lot in my freshman year of high school, but I didn't learn it in the classroom. And at the end of that year, they invited me not to come back.
And so you have firsthand experience.
Yeah, and I didn't get due process or anything.
I see.
They invited
okay.
me not to come back.
All right.
And I got a notice that I was 1A. And I figured I would join the Air Force.
That was your draft status.
Right.
You were first in line.
I was first in line, and they have a program for people who dropped out of college. It was an international education program where they provide uniforms and guns and everything and send you to a very, very bad place.
I'm familiar with that education institution. And, called United States Army, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
and they sent me a letter saying they'd love to see me at the draft board, and I went and joined the Air Force on the theory that I wouldn't be doing anything. I wouldn't be going to Vietnam, and if I did go to Vietnam, I wouldn't be doing anything dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And much to my chagrin, they sent me to Vietnam doing something very dangerous. And we were in crypto analysis and code breaking, and doing that in Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, and did that for a year. And the unit is one of the most decorated combat units in the history of the Air Force Security Service, the 6994th.
If I understood, you actually had to get up in airplanes and fly around.
Right. As a matter of fact, they were World War II airplanes, C-47s, the old DC-3. And the reason we used those airplanes is because they could fly low and slow so that we could get radio fixes on targets.
Low and slow.
Low and slow and unarmed. Low,
region.
Slow and unarmed.
And
our
nobody ever shot at you.
Our squadron, we were shot at and shot down quite a bit. And the squadron motto, we had a little thing we wore in our flight suit, was alone, unarmed, and unafraid. And I always told them they got two of those right. They disbanded the unit I was in Pleiku because we had lost so many planes. And a group of us went to Saigon, and a group of us went to, which is down south, and Da Nang, and into Thailand, and finished the war there. And so that's what we did, and we were the most decorated unit in the history of the Air Force Security Service. We won the Presidential Unit Citation. Many of us, including myself, won the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Mm-hmm. And that is a very, very high award.
It is. It is a high award. I was a bit of a pill, I think, for my senior people in the squadron, and I didn't find out I had been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross until after I got home. And I always told them I would give it back if I could have just seen the look on the face of my superiors when they found out I'd been awarded it.
So you're a troublemaker from way back.
I started out of eighth grade in a Carmelite monastery, which is, I was studying to be a priest. And
this gets better
Niagara
and better,
Falls, Ontario.
Uh-huh.
Niagara Falls, Ontario. And the I got there. Remember, out of eighth grade, they tell you that when you become a priest, you have to take a vow of poverty, obedience, and celibacy. And, of course, being in eighth grade, I thought, well, my parents aren't rich, and I've always pretty much done what people told me, and I don't like celery. So I figured I'd be good being a priest. And then about junior year of high school, I said, what? this isn't going to work. So.
And on that note, we really need to bring this to a conclusion. But Ed Kelly, thank you so very much for coming in and telling us what being a university counsel at a big state university involves and all the fascinating constitutional issues. We really appreciate your coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to my good buddy, Ed Kelly of East Tennessee State University. Didn't he have great stories? He's got a bunch more. We'll have to have him on sometime in the future. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rose. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our theme song is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.